Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgebel, open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host.
A district court judge granted the City of Glenwood Springs motion to intervene in a lawsuit filed by Rocky Mountain Industries against Garfield County. The suit alleges that Garfield County has no regulatory authority over operations at RMI's Mid-Continent Limestone Quarry because the federal government also regulates the site. The city intervened in support of the county and because of its own interests, including proximity to the quarry. According to a city press release, the court agreed with the city's position. RMI has applied to expand the existing site from 15.7 acres to 447 acres. The expanded mine would operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Jazz Aspen Snowmass has canceled this year's Labor Day experience. The Aspen Times reports that all artists scheduled to perform, including Stevie Nicks, Eric Church, Kings of Leon, and Maren Morris, have committed to next year's September dates. Tickets will remain on sale for the 2021 event. Current general admission ticket holders can transfer tickets to next year's event, donate the value of the ticket to JAS, or request a refund.
Eagle County announced today that the 81st Annual County Fair and Rodeo has been canceled this year due to the pandemic. But the Colorado State University Extension 4-H program has plans for an exhibitor-only competition, and the Junior Livestock Sales Commission hopes to have an online auction. Those details should be released soon.
Staff at Shooter's Grill in Rifle are now wearing masks and guns. And reports the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, they're serving customers inside the building, contrary to state orders. Owner Lauren Boebert says the governor's order is unconstitutional. Boebert told Garfield County commissioners this week that she wants the county to be 100% open. Commissioner John Martin told the Daily Sentinel that he understands Boebert's point of view, but the county has regulations it must follow, and that Boebert is in open violation of the governor's order.
And now, owner Lauren Boebert has been served with a cease and desist order. After providing dine-in service on Tuesday and Wednesday and ignoring requests to come into compliance late last week, she was issued the order by the Garfield County Sheriff's Office Wednesday evening. A county press release said Wednesday's diners finished their meals, but nobody else was allowed into the building. State and local orders prohibit restaurants from offering dine-in services until May 27th. Boebert says the orders are unconstitutional.
And in the continuing saga of Shooter's Grill and Rifle, the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that owner Lauren Boebert roped off street-side parking spaces outside her restaurant Thursday and set up tables where staff served customers. She claims that the county's cease and desist order, which was served Wednesday, does not say she can't serve on the premises. Garfield County Commissioner Tom Jankowski is worried that her behavior will jeopardize the county's request for a variance from the state for businesses to open. And Garfield County Sheriff Lou Valerio wrote on the department's Facebook page that he will not arrest anyone who violates the health orders.
As of Friday, May 15th, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported 21,323 confirmed cases of COVID-19, up from 18,827 cases reported May 8th. By Friday, May 15th, 1,150 people who had COVID-19 had died. 878 of those deaths were directly related to the virus. The total death count in the state is up by 190. In Garfield County, between May 3rd and May 12th, 8 new cases of COVID-19 were confirmed, bringing the county total to 113. Deaths remain at 2. Eagle County reported as of Friday 568 confirmed cases, up 14 from last week, with 8 deaths total. Pitkin County reported 71 confirmed cases, up from 54. The death toll there remains at 2. Warm weather and cabin fever are bringing more people outside. White River National Forest rangers reported higher than normal use of the forest last weekend, including some potentially dangerous situations. I spoke with Forest Public Affairs Officer David Boyd about why the danger is more acute this summer.
So every Monday morning, we get together with the rangers over the phone, and everybody checks in, and each ranger district was talking about how many people were out on the forest over the weekend, that the use is much higher than it normally is at this time of the year. And that also each district had been seeing a number of incidents with, I guess you just call it bad behavior, you know.
That's David Boyd, White River National Forest Public Affairs Officer.
Things like leaving trash and a lot of abandoned campfires. And in one case, a group of people were base jumping off the cliffs above Hanging Lake, and a person got injured.
It's not that base jumping is illegal, says Boyd.
Right now is not a good time to be exercising high-risk behavior, right? Emergency personnel are trying to focus locally and stay focused on the pandemic. And so when they're having to do search and rescue or respond to a fire, say, because someone left an abandoned campfire, that's pulling resources away from where we want them focused right now.
Basically, if someone hurts themselves in the high country or there's a fire, emergency responders are stretched thin.
When people are lost or injured on the forest, that involves the Forest Service, but also local search and rescue and sheriff department and, you know, other first responders. And of course, we all are responding when there's fires. So that's the federal resources, but also the state and local resources too.
He adds that no fires are allowed anywhere on the forest. Let me repeat that. No fires are allowed anywhere on the forest, which is different from the usual phased restrictions issued throughout the summer.
That really was something that was put into place at the regional level. It didn't have to do with conditions. It was to, you know, make sure that we were getting our seasonal resources in place and that we had plans to social distance fighting wildfires. I mean, that's going to be a very different thing that we're doing this year.
Campgrounds and built amenities remain closed on the White River National Forest. The public is asked to stay off muddy or closed roads, don't build a fire, and pack out your trash. You can find more information about closures and restrictions at the White River National Forest website.
As in previous years, the Carbondale Farmers Market will run from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays beginning June 10th and continuing through September 30th. Unlike previous years, the market will include new norms for social distancing. Market manager Jamie Wall explains.
Kind of like a one entrance, one exit type situation and, you know, one-way traffic flow around it, maybe, you know, clockwise type thing.
Additionally, face coverings will be required for vendors, volunteers, and customers.
There won't be any, you know, kid activities or music just because farmers markets are considered essential business and it is a privilege to have us open. So we have to follow the guidelines of no social gatherings, so you won't see picnic tables or music, you know, kind of things that would promote gathering.
Confirmed vendors will provide fresh produce, hot food, and artisan goods. The market will once again feature double-up food bucks for SNAP recipients, allowing persons with food stamps to double that value when purchasing from local agricultors.
It's going to be a little different. It might be a little more quiet without the music, but it's just important to still support our local businesses and farmers.
And for persons wishing to support our local producers, but still unsure about the risk of venturing out, Carbondale Farmers Market is also exploring online ordering and scheduled pickup at the market.
This one does cost me a little bit of money, but I think it'd be great for those who don't maybe want to be exposed to a bunch of people. And, you know, our budget is a little tight this year, so we are still accepting donations and sponsors, and I hope it goes well.
For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
Colorado's community health centers are getting creative and going mobile to serve homeless communities during the coronavirus pandemic. From the Colorado News Connection, Eric Galatis has more.
Peak Vista Community Health Centers has established a new homeless specialty clinic at a shelter in Colorado Springs. Ann Beer with the center says the move makes it much easier for people experiencing homelessness to access medical and behavioral care and social services during the health emergency.
Moving the clinic down there was a way for us to be a lot closer to people who might not be feeling very good. We also took with us the capability of doing the COVID testing.
Beer says so far, no one has tested positive for COVID-19 at the homeless isolation shelter set up inside City Auditorium, where Peak Vista sends its mobile health services van daily, or at the city's largest shelter, the Springs Rescue Mission, the site of its specialty clinic. Community health centers have also expanded their telehealth services, which helps limit exposure at clinics and also helps them reach people quarantined in hotel rooms or people living outside of shelters. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says frequently her clients don't have access to the technology that makes telehealth possible.
And so in many cases, we're having to use medical staff or clinical staff taking computers with them to the people so that they can make that connection to their healthcare provider.
Alderman says people experiencing homelessness are especially vulnerable because many have underlying conditions that increase their risk for complications from the coronavirus. She adds that because they don't have a place of their own or round-the-clock access to soap and running water, most can't follow stay-at-home orders or other CDC recommendations, including frequent hand washing.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for KDNK.
Governor Jared Polis met with President Trump on Wednesday at the White House to seek more federal aid and talk about Colorado's response to the coronavirus outbreak.
Trump praised Polis for starting to reopen Colorado's economy, saying he is doing a, quote, fantastic job. Polis has been critical of the administration's response to the outbreak, saying it was slow to send testing kits and medical supplies. But he says he accepted the White House invitation because the partnership with the federal government is important.
We need all hands on deck, setting any ideological beefs aside, to be able to work together to save lives and restore our economy to strength.
Polis says he urged the president to extend a federal program that is providing Colorado nursing homes with masks and other protective equipment. He also touted the state's phased approach to reopening and said he hopes some ski areas can reopen next month. I'm Scott Franz in Denver.
State stay-at-home orders and social distancing related to COVID-19 have closed Bureau of Land Management long-term Mustang holding facilities to the public. The Los Alamos Daily Post reports that horse care on the public off-range pastures continues, but wild horse advocates are concerned that lack of public scrutiny puts the animals at risk. The BLM manages most of the wild horses in burros on public lands in 10 western states, including 5 herds in Colorado. Over 48,000 Mustangs and burros are in off-range holding facilities, according to BLM statistics, as of April 2020. 4 facilities in Wyoming, Kansas, and Oklahoma are open to the public, but many more are not. The Daily Post reports that holding facility contractors remain responsible for the animals and that BLM says the Mustang's welfare remains a top priority. But advocates, such as the American Wild Horse Campaign, say that with the annual tours of the facilities and on-site visits canceled, contractors and the agency will not be accountable to anyone. According to the BLM, the public off-range pastures will reopen to visitors when lockdown, social distancing, and other COVID-19 orders in Wyoming, Kansas, and Oklahoma have been lifted.
You're listening to the Weekly News Reel, featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. Grassroots TV also partners with KDNK to air live Pitkin County public health and community meetings. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Testing, testing. Family nurse practitioner Lisa Robiano and registered nurse Maria McHale of Mid Valley Family Practice spoke with KDNK's Lucas Turner about the growing number of people without health insurance who need COVID-19 testing. They also shared insights about mass community testing with Mirabus, explained some of the key differences between COVID-19 and the flu, and emphasized the importance of maintaining social distancing and wearing a mask.
For a number of months here, there has been no place for newly uninsured people to be seen. And so, though it's really wonderful to say, yes, call your provider and get a test, well, a lot of people don't have providers because there was no access for the newly uninsured patient. And that is a big issue. And so we've been trying to address that. So we were fortunate and got a grant from Rocky Mountain Health Foundation to see people who were uninsured, physically see them and evaluate them and treat them. This was within our office setting. This is not with the mass community screenings and testing. And of course, that money is well gone. And so we're looking for people, we're asking for donations and writing grants because we have a nonprofit to try to get money to see people who are sick, who are newly uninsured. All these people that were temporarily furloughed are now being laid off permanently. So they're losing their income and they're losing their insurance status. And so we are going to have a huge crisis. And unless there's enough providers to see people who are uninsured, the newly underinsured, then we're going to have a bigger issue.
From your perspective of somebody who's doing testing and seeing sick people, is it wise to be reopening right now? Or is it okay because we're doing these sort of precautions?
I think reopening is going to happen. And what we have to do is not get relaxed with the guidelines that were given by the CDC, continue using the mask, continue isolating. I see so many people just hanging out, and it has gotten lonely, and we do miss our friends, and we do miss our life, and the summer is approaching, and it makes you want to get out and be together in groups, but it's the fear that then we're going to go back again to where we were. And so what people need to do is, yeah, if you must return to work, because many of us are living paycheck to paycheck, then do it with the biggest caution and wearing the mask and going straight from work to home. People need to still be very cognizant that COVID is still there and it's still a threat, and that although things seem to be returning to normal, nothing is normal. The death rate is still climbing. And the Valley has COVID here, and it's here, and it's easy to acquire. And many of the people that were positive, I was very curious to ask them, hey, you're positive. How did you feel? And many of them were like, oh, I only felt ill a couple days. Some only lost their sense of smell, and that was the only thing. And so you can be unaware that you are sick. And then you pass it to that one person that isn't going to have those mild symptoms.
What do you say to people who say, well, it's just like the flu?
Unlike the flu, it can cause permanent changes or damage to the lungs of someone affected by this. It can cause clotting because it has some effects on the clotting system of the body. I know that it can infect not only just the lungs, it can infect the heart, kidneys, brain. And so I tell them that it's bigger than the flu. The flu can also have very deadly complications and be fatal to people. But this is so contagious and so many people are affected so quickly.
And it's more insidious. It masks itself in different ways. And so, you know, people walking around and not even knowing they have it. Mm-hmm. People with incredibly different symptoms. It's a great masquerader, and that is the big difference.
Right. So is there anything that you'd want to speak to in terms of the importance of social distancing for keeping our healthcare system locally from having a breach?
You know, people speak about inpatient, and they talk about hospitalizations, and they talk about capacity of the hospital beds and the ICUs. That's a really important indicator. But from a human standpoint, what we're looking at is, as this grows and gets bigger, we're looking at people who are going to be out of work. We're looking at devastation of families who can't afford rent, can't afford to eat. We're looking at bypassing, not even paying attention to regular screenings for cancer. We're looking at missing out on regular appointments for chronic diseases. So while it's important to look at the sheer numbers and the statistics, we also have to look at the impact on the individual. And, you know, from an economic standpoint, where's all this money that is going towards taking care of people with COVID coming from? Well, they don't have enough money to
take care of people in jail. They don't have enough money to take care of people, children, and mental health issues. So every time somebody doesn't put a mask on their face and they spread COVID, they are taking money directly out of somebody else's pocket and not allowing them to pay their rent, not allowing them to have a job. I mean, it's very selfish to not put on a mask.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
In other news, the U.S. Forest Service last week issued its final decision for a regional logging project, which has been reduced in size from the original proposal by more than 9,000 acres. KDNK's Kathleen Shannon spoke with Matt Reed of High Country Conservation Advocates about the shift.
Tell me about the Taylor Park Vegetation Management Project.
In 2018, the Forest Service came to the public with a proposal for a large logging project in Taylor Park in Gunnison County. And the focus of that was ostensibly for mistletoe eradication. Mistletoe is a naturally occurring organism in lodgepole forests, but is seen as counterproductive to timber volume by the agency. So this raised some red flags at our organization, especially the road mileage that would be needed. Also impacts to lynx habitat in the area, some pretty big clear cuts, all in all added up to a project that was large and likely to have some significant impacts.
The scope of the project has been reduced because of your efforts and also those of the Center for Biological Diversity, which is a nonprofit, and the independent consultant Rocky Smith. What does that process look like when conservation groups take on the Forest Service or other similar agencies?
NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act, and in very much a nutshell, every project on public lands by law is required to go through a public process that includes public comments, environmental assessments. It's kind of the process to which the public is given a voice in decision-making affecting public lands. Near the end of the process, the Forest Service upped the acreage to about 29,000 acres. And our organization, Center for Biological Diversity and Rocky Smith, jointly filed an administrative objection to this, which is really our last bite at the apple, short of litigation, to influence the final decision. And we won on that point. And the Forest Service agreed that they had not done the legally required NEPA analysis to support that acreage expansion to 29,000 acres, and they reduced that by about half. And they also incorporated about 4,000 acres of prescribed fire, which our organization is generally supportive of prescribed fire as a management tool on the landscape.
Are there any things working in your favor when advocacy groups navigate the landscape of taking on these sorts of proposals?
It's good to have an engaged public, and that was the case here with the Taylor Park project. Pretty early on, the communities in and around Taylor Park were made aware of this and expressed concern and also expressed some support. There's a lot of folks who support this in support of the initial proposal, but having public engagement is key, and Taylor Park being an increasingly popular landscape. This came to the attention of a lot of people. So right off the bat, you had a level of participation from the community that you don't always see in similar projects. And I think that's one of the roles that conservation groups and the public can play is pointing out to the Forest Service things that might not have been considered, advocating for consideration of issues and impacts that just hadn't been done. And we won on that point for this project.
Garfield County Commissioners Monday approved amendments to the county's Land Use and Development Code, which expand 1041 powers to gravel operations and mineral extraction. The Colorado Legislature passed HB 1041, the Areas and Activities of State Interest Act, in the mid-1970s due to rapid growth in the state when many counties didn't even have land use codes. 1041 powers allow local governments to have regulatory control of impacts of certain types of land uses. Garfield County can already do this with airports and other land uses, but this new amendment will expand 1041 to include gravel and mineral extraction. At a Facebook forum earlier this month, Glenwood Springs City Attorney Carl Hanlon explained that this amendment would apply to the proposed expansion of the Mid-Continent Limestone Quarry.
If they file an expansion application, which they currently will need to, probably at the end of the process with the BLM, they'll need to file for that expansion, then those new 1041 regulations would apply to the expansion of the quarry.
He said the code expansion would give the county more tools to deal with mining impacts inside the city of Glenwood Springs.
It's an important step in dealing with not only this operation, but obviously other operations that might be occurring in other places or might occur in the future in other places in the county.
According to the Post-Independent, commissioners and county staff received 80 public comments throughout the amendment process, mostly in support of expanding the code. Commissioners also lifted a moratorium Monday that had been in place since last November on new or amended mining and gravel operations. Finally, the Garfield County Library District opened all branches this week with restrictions.
It's really hard for me to even describe the amount of work, stress, and pressure a core group of library employees have been under for the last few weeks.
That's Brett Lear, director of the Garfield County Public Library District, at last week's Library Board of Trustees meeting.
I think it's only gotten more intense with us deciding to do a modest reopening on Monday.
Lear said the library has completely flipped its service model due to the pandemic and that staff has been under a lot of pressure. All library branches in the county have been closed since late March. Book drops reopen on May 4th for a few hours each day. Branch buildings open under restrictions today, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week.
We're going to close off just about all public areas other than a path to a service desk, but we won't offer access to public computers, to public bathrooms, to the book stacks, because we don't have the capacity to run around with, you know, Lysol and a cloth and swab down everything that people would touch if they were to be wandering around the library.
Other restrictions include two patrons in the library at a time. With workforce at 50% in all buildings, no more than a total of 10 people will be allowed in a building at a time.
We're doing social distancing even outside of our building with the queues that'll form. Emily's done a nice job of creating markings that we'll put on the sidewalks outside the building to keep people spaced that way.
Patrons can expect to see plexiglass dividers at the front desk and staff wearing masks. The public will also have to wear masks in order to get into the buildings.
If somebody refuses to wear a mask, that's fine, but they can't come in. We'll bring the materials out to them.
Phase 1 will continue until public health orders allow more than 10 people in one space. The library will not be offering classes and events in the buildings. Public meeting rooms will remain closed. Lear said that staff will not be cleaning books.
All materials will go into a 72-hour quarantine. You know, the CDC says really it probably takes about 24 hours for the virus to die. But most libraries in the state are doing 72 just to be super cautious.
He added that it's been challenging to get guidelines from the county health department throughout the pandemic.
You know, I asked them for specific metrics around, you know, when we do reopen, you know, could you give us a metric for, you know, how many people to have in the building? And, you know, they really said that they did not have a metric to share. That's why I went with the 10 that's, you know, applied to group gatherings.
Kevin Hetler, district financial manager, told trustees that library revenue from sales tax will probably take a hit this year, but that it does not affect revenue from ballot measure 6A. Libraries will be open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 3, Tuesday and Thursday from 2 to 6. That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.